So we're here on Yud Zayin. Let's see where we get up to. I think by tomorrow we'll be able to make a siyum on the first perek, hopefully. That'll be exciting if anyone wants to bring make some schnapps. Okay. So the last thing we discussed was the case on the bottom of Yud Zayin Amud Aleph of Rav Kahana HaSanhedrin Shero Kulam Lechova. It was a very paradoxical halacha. All the Rishonim, with the exception of one, interpreted to mean that if there's a unanimous decision to condemn the accused to death, then he goes scot-free. And that was based on a halacha called Halona Sadin, that we have to, the Dayanim have to spend some time looking and coming up with some sort of a heter, you know, some sort of mitigating circumstance under which they could acquit the accused, and they won't be able to do so if they look to the left or the right. Everybody clearly agrees that the evidence is so crystal clear that this person is guilty as accused of a capital crime. And that's called, in the language of the Gemara here, Hani Tu Lo Chazile. They will not be able to see any sort of a mitigating circumstance. But we did mention that there was at least one Rishon who disagrees with this, and that was the Tosa Rush. And he says that what the Gemara means is that we kill this person immediately, because since nobody's going to find any sort of justification or any sort of vindication for this criminal, we might as well put him together to death on the same day. So what we're up to for today and begin the week is Omer Rabbi Yochanan. So if everybody could look on Daf Yud Zayin Amud Alf towards the bottom, about three lines up from the bottom, Omer Rabbi Yochanan. Now it's very interesting that the underlying premise of Rabbi Yochanan is that we need what's called Emas Hadayonim. And what that means is we have to guarantee that the people will be in awe of the judges. You know, this concept that in Western culture called contempt of court is really a very, very Jewish concept. Its origin is in our Torah, our halacha. There are many, many dinim about contempt of court, which is called zilusa de beidina. No, not to be mezalzel, not to denigrate the bezdin. It's very important. Just like we have to have Ema, we have to have awe for the Melech, for the King of Israel, and many halachas apply to the King, so too we have to have Ema for the Dayanim, for the judges, otherwise there won't be the proper respect and attitude towards the court. And in that context, Rabbi Yochanan says there are many qualifications that the judge has to have in order to sit on the court. And those qualifications all reflect this concept called Emas Hadayonim Mutelis Alabrios, which you'll see in Rashi, Dibra Maskel Bale Koma. So if you count up from the bottom of the page, you might want to underline about 10 lines, no, less than 10 lines up, maybe 8 lines up from the bottom of the page. Shetehe Emosan Mutelis Alabrios. You have that Rashi? That Rashi really gives us the key to unlock the mystery of what Rabbi Yochanan's talking about. Because Rabbi Yochanan is going to say that if you're not such a tall person, I don't know if I would be able to be on the Sanhedrin according to Rabbi Yochanan. Last time I checked, I was 5'7", but somebody told me I'm not even 5'7". My father, may rest in peace, was 5'4". He wore what's called Adler shoes. I don't know if those who... Yeah, they have an insert inside. You know, that gave him an extra 2 inches. And then when he gave his drasha, he had a platform. A little platform was another 2 inches. So, you know, he looked like a tall guy. You know what I'm saying? But there was a president at the Yeshiva University. I don't know if you ever heard of him. His name is Dr. Bernard Revel. And he discouraged my father from going into the rabbinate. He said, you know, because Revel came from Texas. So in Texas, they were all tall. You know, my father was 5'4". So he said that my first, you know, he didn't call him rabbi. He was still learning for smicha. He said, I don't think the rabbinate is for you. So my father said, I'm going to prove you wrong. You know, and then my father went into the rabbinate.
So, but do we know that Balikoma means physically? Maybe he means by bialei koma, people of stature in terms of, you know.
But take a look at the next line. King he Sol, says, Sol, you need bialei mara, you know. Bialei mara, we're going to see that you have
King
to
King Saul and King David, they shot. King Saul shot up.
You know, right. He was very cool. Meshif of Amal.
All this special thing that they made him.
But bialei mara means he's got to be at least appealing in his looks. I mean, we're talking about physical qualifications here. Okay, so let's see the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Om Rabbi Yochanan. Ein moshivin b'sanhedrin. Number one, bialei koma. Number two, bialei chochma. We'll see what that means in a minute. Rabbi Yonah has a new twist on that. Bialei mara. Bialei zikna. We have to figure out what that means. Ubalei kshafim. These are experts in witchcraft or sorcery. Then we're going to talk about how many languages they know. So, you know, at the end of this list, you wonder if anyone on the face of the earth could qualify to be on the court. But let's go through this, and let's talk for a moment about bialei chochma. Now, bialei chochma, at face value, seems to mean that they know the halacha. They know, intellectually, they've mastered the knowledge that you need to be a judge, but the Ben Yehoyada, who writes a super commentary on Shas, which is the same author as the Ben Ish Chai, if he's more famous for that work, he says it can't be that that bialei chochma means knowledge, because obviously, you know, I don't need Rabbi Yochanan to tell me that the man has to have knowledge in order to sit on the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, either 23 judges or 70 judges, are made up of the greatest scholars of the generation. Why would Rabbi Yochanan feel it necessary to tell me that the first qualification on his list is going to be bialei chochma? So the Ben Yehoyada comes up with a whole new pshat. Okay. He says the following. Again, this is really quite revolutionary. He says, HaKavona lechachmas hateva v'shar hachochmos. We're not talking about Torah. We're talking about the knowledge of science and other disciplines. Why would a judge in Israel who has to come to a final decision about the halacha have to be a scientist?
The astronomer.
He says shalafamim, because he says from time to time, tzrichim adayanim lechachmos elu, the dayana might need that knowledge of science, beinyonim aboyim lefneim, in various cases that come in front of them. So, for example, in Kiddush HaChodesh, you mentioned, Yaakov, you know, you'd have to know astronomy, but the truth is that there are many other sciences that are very, very important. Psychology.
Rabbi Schwab is the goal of science. He used to have a prescription to Scientific American. He used to read it through,
cover to cover. My Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, also knew a lot about science and medicine. I mean, all these issues are very relevant. Today we live in contemporary life. You know, there's so much technology, so much advancement in medicine in every area. You know, imagine having to paskin on these things. You know, they say about Rav Moshe Feinstein that before he went into surgery, he had to have a surgery in his older age. He asked his son-in-law to tell him what exactly would happen as a result of surgery. Would it be possible to sit in the Sanhedrin? And he had to know science for that. So he didn't have all the science at his fingertips. He asked his son-in-law, who's a biologist, exactly what would be the nature of his pagam, you know, of his physical ailment. My father, Olav Shalom, told me about a certain individual named Dr. Falk Schlesinger. I don't know if the name rings a bell. He was the founder of the Shari Tzedek Hospital. And he once invited a group of American rabbis on their trip to Israel to come to his house in Yerushalayim. And he had two Madafei Sfarim, you know, he had one on the right for his science books, he was a great physician, and on the left he had all his Torah books. So he turned to the rabbi and he said, the problem with that generation is you have those who know this set of books, and those who know this set of books, so there are very few who know both. Yeah. You know, that was the Rambam, they say, knew all the science of his, almost all the Rishonim, the Chachmei Sfarad. They knew all the science of their generation. So that's one interpretation, a new view of what bialei chochma is. Now we have bialei mara. So just read to you the footnote here. He says that Rashi tells us that why do they have to be bialei koma, bialei mara? Kedesha tehe emosam muteles al habrios. That was the Rashi that we that we pointed out before, and Rashi combines Balei Koma u Balei Mara. It sounds like Rashi had a slightly different gear, so maybe the Balei Chochma was written either first or at the end of this list. So Rashi combines Balei Mara and Balei Koma together. Again, you know, the Sanhedrin would have to appoint the members of the Sanhedrin based on their evaluation. You know, how good looking is good looking, how ugly is ugly. You know, at what point do you say that you don't fit Balei Koma or Balei Mara, and that the Emas Hadayonim Aleim will be undermined? Now, what is Balei Zikna? Yeah.
The note here says that the height and imposing appearance are characteristics that imbue fear of the judge.
Right. I would say awe. I don't know. I don't like the word fear. That's, I mean, right. I'm afraid of a tall guy, but most of us are not afraid of tall people. But there's a certain awe that you have for someone who's tall. It doesn't mean you have to be 7'2" and a star basketball player, but not to be too short. Now, what does Balei Zikna mean? So he has a footnote here in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah, which again changes the whole pshat. I'm going to give you the bottom line and then we'll go through his logic. The bottom line is that Balei Zikna means middle-aged, not too young and not too old. And how does Rabbeinu Yonah know that that's what Balei Zikna means? I mean, Zikna sounds like an older person. So he tells us that we have to refer to a sugya later on in Sanhedrin, on Daf Lamed Vav Amid Beis, and the Gemara says that we don't appoint an elderly person to the Sanhedrin. We'll soon see why. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says that we have to get a Baal Zikna in order to be on Sanhedrin. So how do we reconcile, says Rabbi Yonah, the fact that the Gemara says that you don't appoint a Zaken, an elderly person, to the Sanhedrin? And at the same time, Rabbi Yochanan says that this is one of the basic qualifications. He's got to be one of the Balei Zikna. El Kavanas Rabbi Yochanan, what does Rabbi Yochanan have in mind here? Says Rabbeinu Yonah, Kidele Shalola Hoshiv Bachurim B'Sanhedrin. That we're not supposed to appoint young people to the Sanhedrin. How did Rabbeinu Yonah explain such a thing? The exclusion of the older people and the younger people, and we need someone who, relative to the Bachurim, to the youngsters, is called a Baal Zikna, but on the other hand, he's not really a Zaken. He says the following: Hatam She'ein Moshivim Zaken. If you study the sugya later on at Daf Lamed Vav carefully, you'll see that the reason why we don't appoint a Zaken, an older person, to the court. By the way, can anybody guess why? This I'm saying as a challenge, because I came up with three answers and none of them are right.
he won't last as long as someone.
Right, he won't live long enough. What else?
He's stubborn in his ways.
He's not so sharp.
He's not so sharp. He starts forgetting his learning.
He's not as much.
So I came up with all of this.
And
Rabbeinu Yonah says a whole different reason. Why don't we appoint a Zaken? Listen carefully. Shukvar shachach tzar gidul bonin. He doesn't remember what it means to raise children. V'lachein ein lo rachmanus kol kach. He doesn't have enough of an attribute of compassion. Who feels compassion? Those who are raising children. V'atam l'zeh she'ein lo hoshiv bachurim shadayin einom yodim b'tzar gidul bonim. They haven't yet raised children. So we need that middle age of those who are empathizing with Gidul Bonim, and out of that sense of empathy for the suffering of their children, they will have empathy on the clients, you know, those who are on trial. Now, it's very interesting to me that according to Rabbeinu Yonah's presentation, we have to find Balei Rachmanus. You know, we spoke about some of the ethical qualities of a member of the Sanhedrin. He's got to be someone who's interested in truth, and he's not subject to bribery. But we never spoke about compassion as a prerequisite in a judge. And you know, 1,000 questions come to my mind. You know, what happens if you have a person who is middle-aged but he has no children, or let's say he ships off his children to an institution and he doesn't feel low plug, obviously, but I'm just pointing out that you know, that the actual application of Rabbeinu Yonah is a little differently.
But Baal Tefillah for the Yom Nerum, we say the same thing. We want somebody that is
will come and plead the case because he feels
the same quality.
So, yeah. But I don't know if it says anywhere that a Zaken can't be a Baal Tefillah, as far as I know. A bachur, yes, you know, he has to have a beard.
At least 13.
Right, but I don't think it says that a 70-year-old. I don't think the 70-year-old is excluded as a shliach tzibur.
His voice changes, though. So that might be the criteria.
Right. What else do we have here? Balik Shofin. So Rashi points out here, you'll see about seven lines up before the end of the page. Lahamis Machshefin. So that if there's if you have to adjudicate in the case of a so-called accused machshefa or machashev, so they know what kishuf is all about. It's a whole science of kishuf. Today we don't really have that science, but back in the day they had it. So abotchim v'kshafeim linotzel midei bezdin. Oh wow. Rashi adds another element into the equation. He says that these people who are experts in sorcery will know how to use their powers of evil in order to protect themselves against the condemnation of the Bezdin. Ulegalos alamachshefim amastirim umadichim bechishfeim kegoda mitzriim. So Rashi says that if you don't know exactly kishuf, you don't know the mechanism, the mechanics of kishuf, then they could fool you, and that you wouldn't even know that you were subject to their spell. And he quotes the Mitzrim, that the Mitzrim were the Bali kishuf. I mean, the Torah itself describes the Mitzrim as experts in kishuf. So we got to get members of Sanhedrin who will know how to protect themselves against kishuf. Now, exactly how many members of the Sanhedrin does each single member have to be an expert in Torah Sakishuf, or is it enough that one be the expert? So let me read to you the footnote here. It says the following. One second. He says, in the name of the Yaivitz, that's Rav Yaakov Emdin, that the first part of Rashi indicates Kadesha Yuchlu Lahomis Machshefem, which means that we have to be protected and we have to be empowered with the ability to counter against the Kishuf. But he says he doesn't believe that Rashi should be taken literally, that the lives of the Dayanim will be exposed to physical danger or maybe even the danger of death based on kishuf. He says, Sharei, if you take Rashi literally, I have the following problem. Ein heim rashoim lilmod zos el kidei lahovin ulahoros v'dei lo kidei lasos. He says the following, that when we encourage, you know, in the, let's say, the school that trains Dayanim to take a course in Kishuv, we only encourage the Dayanim, the future Dayanim, to understand Kishuv on an abstract level so that they can issue a horah, a verdict, in a case of someone who's accused of Kishuv. They have to know the science of Kishuv. But v'lo kidei lasos, we never allow the Dayanim, when they study Kishuv, to take it from an abstract level of Havana and bring it down to the level of Asiya to implement what they learned and what they studied on an abstract level. Why? Sha'odam sha'osa kishuv chayav misa. That if a person actually does an act of kishuv, that itself is a criminal capital crime. Now, you might say, well, if my life is in danger, then maybe I'm allowed to do kishuv to save my life. That's going to be an issue, not here, but in the Gemara Pesachim. But even if I come to the conclusion that in some case I'm allowed to do kishuv, but not based on the possibility that maybe, you know, maybe I'll die. Ella, but rather what Rashi means is, shetzrichim adayonim lahovin es maisa kishuv. They have to know exactly what the act of kishuf is. Kidei lahoros, kidei ladasu lahoros im chayav misa. V'chein tzrichem em leida keitza levatel es ma'isa kishuv. Not to do a ma'isa kishuv, but to do a bittel of ma'isa kishuv. Again, it's a very subtle distinction. I mean, what's the difference between an act of sorcery and an act that protects you against sorcery? You really have to be a big lamdan to know the difference. But not even if you're using kishuv as a protective measure, that's fine, but don't misunderstand Rashi and think that Rashi means that the dayanim are allowed to do kishuv in an active sense. The Ode, and he says furthermore, there's something called Sefer HaYetzira, which is apparently a secret work based on how God created the world. And the halacha is that if a person has to do something that's supernatural, for whatever reason, then Yesh Heter LaSosav, then in certain cases, although they can't do an act of Kishuv, but what they could do is Lishtamesh b'sefer hayitzira, or to use the Shem HaMeforosh, Lahomis Adam al yidei Shem HaMeforosh, K'mo she'asa Moshe la'mitzri. In other words, if you insist that Rashi would allow the Dayanim in self-defense against these Machshefim to use Kishuv, he says that's only under one of two possibilities. Either they're allowed to use the Sefer Yitzira, or they're allowed to use the Shem HaMeforosh. But they can't use actual Kishuv in this interpretation. In the first interpretation, they can only use a Kishuv Levatel HaSakishuv, but not an active Kishuv. However, the Yavetz admits that there is another Rashi in Shas, not here, and that's a Masechta Menachos. V'nirami Rashi, it seems from Rashi, that the Dayanim are allowed to actually kill someone with Kishuv. Shekavonis Rashi Shiyamisuhu Adayonim Al Yidei Kishuv Mamish. That if this person who's standing in trial actually has the ability to use Kishuv, then we can kill him with Kishuv. Mm-hmm. One Kishuv against the other. And Tosus in Masechta Menachos on that Rashi quotes Rav Haigoim, who says, Shetzarch Shiyu Balik Shofim Kidei Leida Asadin. In other words, Tosus is really outspoken in the name of Rav Haigoin that the Dayanim are not allowed to use Kishuv to kill someone, which seems to be the implication of Rashi, but rather Tosus disagrees and he says they have to study Kishuv not to use it in a practical sense. You know, today they have a concept called practical Kabbalah. Have you heard of this? Okay, I don't want to tell you about that. Anyway, he says, Me'achar Shirak Mechashe Fosa Maisa is Chayav Misa. Okay, fine. There's a lot more here, but that's enough for us. Now, how many languages do the members of the court have to know? Unbelievable. It says here in Rabbi Yochanan, Yodim b'shivim lashon. They have to know 70 languages. I don't know. I know people who know. Pharaoh. I met a person who knows 9 languages. I never know.
Pharaoh did.
Yeah, but I never met a person, I don't know, maybe you did, who knows 70 languages.
Pharaoh.
You met him?
No,
yeah, I'm asking, did you ever meet someone? No. You know, I'm not appointing Pharaoh to the Sanhedrin. The Gemara is actually soon going to give us a list of Chachamim who knew 70 languages. And the Gemara goes through them all by list. But who today knows 70 languages? In any event, what's the purpose of knowing 70 languages? So this is something that we have to study. This is not so simple. But Rabbi Yochanan says, Shalotehe Sanhedrin Shomas Mipi Hamiturgamon. Now, I'm not sure at this point, and this is what we're going to get into, whether we're talking about the Sanhedrin listening to the claims in self-defense of the Nidon who's on trial, or he's talking about listening to the testimony of the Edim who come to testify and give evidence in the case. So let's go slowly. Rashi says at the end of this page that we're talking about Edus, we're talking about testimony. Kishaboyim Edim Lozim, Lozim I mean those who don't speak Lashon Kodesh, they only speak other languages. Lahayid Bifneim, to testify in front of the Sanhedrin. And lo and behold, they're speaking French, and the members of the Sanhedrin don't know French. Lo yitztarchu, if they know all the languages, they won't need lahamid to set up melitzim b'neihem. Now, Rashi used the word melitz, which is a Hebrew translation of the word mitargem. Mitargem means a translator. The Havilei Rashi says, Eid mi pi Eid. In other words, no one's allowed to send their Eidus through an intermediary. They have to personally testify directly into the ears of the Dayanim. So that now that the Dayanim don't understand the Eidus, because it's in a language that they're not familiar with, they're going to need a Meturgamon. And Rashi identifies that with Eid mi pi Eid. We're going to soon see that other Rishonim have a different approach. And I'm going to read to you this note in the name of the Meiri. So again, let's just review Rashi. Rashi says that we have a problem of disqualifying the Eidus because of Eid mi pi Eid. It's like one Eid who heard the Eidus from someone else. The Metargim is the person who heard the testimony from the original Eidim, and that doesn't qualify. However, the Meiri quotes a Gemara Menachos. The Gemara Menachos has a different argument. It's not a psul in Eidus of Eid mi pi Eid, but rather the Torah doesn't trust the Metargim. Why? Shema Yachlif HaMetargim Es Tanosav Shel HaNidon. It could be that the Metargim will, again, I'm not sure if he's doing this deliberately or inadvertently, but he'll change the tone and the content of the arguments here, or of the testimony of the Eid. And what could happen as a result? The Yigrom Lekachshi Chayvu Bedino Shelo Kedin. As a result, the judges may come to condemn someone. You know, the Miri is not so nervous about the opposite, that maybe someone who's guilty might be acquitted. That's not such a problem. That's a problem too, because it's tzedek tiridof. But he's more worried about the problem of Shemi Yigrom Lekachshi Chayvu Bedin Shalokid, and that he's really not chayav because the Metargim changed the content of the Eidus. And then he goes on to point out, V'kol adinim elu lo nemru ela b'Sanhedrin, whether it's the Sanhedrin of 70 or the Sanhedrin of 23. Aval b'bezdin shel shlosha, if we have a classic court made up of three judges, ein l'dagdek b'kol ha'inyonim elu. We don't have to be careful about this. Why? Because to say that maybe the Metargim will falsify the testimony, you know, change it in some radical way, in some significant way, what's the worst that can happen? We're not going to put anyone to death. We're talking about a Beis Din of Shlosha. They don't have the authority to condemn anyone to death. But he says, Mikol Makom, however, there are certain basic requirements that apply even to a Beis Din of three, which is, again, not the subject of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan is talking about appointing a judge to the Sanhedrin. But there are requirements, says the Meiri, with regard to a judge for a Beis Din of three judges. Number one, we need chachma, we need knowledge. Number two, we need anava, we need humility. Number three, we need yiras chet, he has to be fear of God. And number four, we need sinas hamamon ushlemus hamidos. Maybe you could separate those two. You need that they're not interested in money, they're not money grubbers, that they could be bribed. And number five, I guess you could call it, is you need that they're ethically sound. But these requirements, that they have to be bali koma, bali chachma, which we said was they have to know the sciences, according to the Ben Yoyoda, bali mara, bali zikna, bali kshafim, yodim b'shivim lashon, that is a specific requirement that's exclusive to the case of Sanhedrin, where they might have to be judging a case, a capital case, and condemn someone to die. And now, Rabosa, we get to the main sugya for today. Omer Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Whoa. Again, I take a deep breath here because this is a toughie. Ein moshivin b'Sanhedrin, ela mishi yodea l'taher es ha-sheretz min ha-Torah. A sheretz is a via vos hatumah. You know, if you come in contact with a sheretz, whether you touch a sheretz, a dead little animal, or you pick it up, and that's called masa, you become tomeh. And we're looking for a judge who's going to tell you no, that according to the Torah law, the sheretz is tar, and it could not transmit contamination. And how's he going to do this? through what's called a Kal Vachomer. And we're going to soon see that this is not just a theoretical statement of Rav, but that Rav himself is going to derive from a Kal Vachomer that a Sheretz is not Metame, which is against the Torah law. So Tosis here and all the other Rishonim, they go ballistic over here. Well, what's going on over here? How is it possible that in order to sit on Sanhedrin, you have to know how to be Metara Sheretz? What do you mean Metara Sheretz? The Torah says explicitly, there's a whole parasha of Tuma Shrotzim, with all a list of different Shrotzim. So let's see if we could present. I need someone to volunteer to write five numbers here on your page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, with a little space in between. Because we're going to have five different explanations for this Gemara. The first explanation is that of the Yad Ramah, as I told you many times. He's the kingpin on Masechta Sanhedrin. He says the following. Klomar, what the Gemara means, what Rav means, is Laharos mikal vachomer Shehoya hadin nosein Sheyia sheretz tar El shatora mitam oso v'lachein ein lasos maisa bedover. In other words, the chachma of this candidate for Sanhedrin is so great that with his sharp knowledge, he can convince us that if the Torah hadn't explicitly said that a sheretz is mitame, we would have logically come to the conclusion that sheretz is tar. But ein lasos maisa bedover, he's not going to tell us that this is the way we're going to treat it la'alacha with horas bezdim, because the Torah says, in fact, that a sheretz is tameh. But according to the logic of the Torah, which is called kal vachomer, if not for the fact that the Torah explicitly mentions that what? That sheretz is tameh, we would have come to the conclusion that sheretz is tar. Prove that to me. If you can prove that to me, then you're a great candidate for Sanhedrin. Tosis rejects this. Says Tosis, Malonu b'charifu shel hevel l'tayres asheretz me'achash haTorah tamaso. We never find anywhere in Shas what he calls pilpulo shel hevel or charifu shel hevel, meaning this is vanity, this is wasted time to try to come up with a logic that's against the Torah. That's not what we're enjoined to do. Our responsibility is to learn Torah, to explain the Torah, to delve into the meaning of the Torah. Not to tell me, well, what would I have said if not for the Torah, and come up with some fancy pilpul up in the heavens, some sort of a dialectic up in the abstract worlds. Therefore, up to number two. Etosis says, Ein kavana sagamara lemishi yochel l'taras asheretz mikol din tuma elerak l'taro mitumas nevelos dahainu shanose asakizayis min asheretz lo yeitomik din nose kizayis min anevela elerak hanogea b'sheretz atzmo yitame. Okay, here we have to know the sugya of tumas masa, which means that sometimes you can carry something without even touching it. For example, you have an nevela. So an animal died without shechita. If you touch its meat, then that's called tumas maga. Nobody questions that. But then if you lift up the meat that's sitting on a plate, that's called tumas masa, and that applies to nevela. What about a sheretz? Is there someone, that's the question we're addressing to all these candidates, someone in the audience who could tell us that although a sheretz is mitame tumas maga, but it's not like a nevela, and it's not mitame tumas masa, and therefore hanose kizayis min asheretz is not like hanose kizayis min anevela. Again, the shear of nevela for tumas masa is a kizayis. So you have an animal that died, and you take a kizayis worth of its basar and you put it on a plate and you carry the plate without touching the kizayis, your tame. What would be if instead you had a dead sheretz that was large enough to be a kizayis worth? Would you be tame without maga through tumas masa? Again, we would have to know a lot more as we go through this sugya to understand. But Tosis is saying, chas v'sholom, a pilpul shel hevel. We're coming with a pilpul shel emes, because at the end of the day, what we're going to conclude based on the logic, and Rob's going to offer us this logic, is that There's no such thing as kizayis min hasheretz betumas maso. Now we're up to number three. The Meiri. The Meiri says that letairis hasheretz, those three words, which you should put in inverted commas, letairis hasheretz, biderech hafloga nemru. Now the word hafloga means an exaggeration. Don't take this literally. Hakavana, but what does Rav have in mind? Shetzarech lahoshiv b'sanhedrin anoshim chachamim ad mi'od. We need such a high level of wisdom for Sanhedrin. Sheim yiru behemshech hazman eze takola hayotzeis b'din Torah yuchlu lechadesh dinim ulahosiv oligroa horas shah. This, my friends, is very sophisticated. As the older I get, the more it's appealed to me that the Rav, my Rebbe, he wasn't Geiris the Meiri. I mean, you know, once in a while, if you quoted a Meiri and it supported what he said, oh, show me the Meiri, you know. But other than that, the Meiri was like, it was excluded from the classroom. I don't know. I have a couple of theories as to why the Rav didn't like the Meiri, but look at this brilliant, very abstract and complex presentation of the Meiri. The Meiri says the following. Sanhedrin has a double function. We think of Sanhedrin, for sure, as Horas Din, which means that there's a question, there's an issue of the two litigants, and we're in doubt, and there's an ambiguity. They have to clarify the issue based on their infinite wisdom. And that's for sure how we understood the function of the Sanhedrin before we saw this Meiri. But the Meiri says no. There's a second function, a second responsibility. And I'm not sure, it may even be more important than the first. And he says that they have to understand the generation, and they have to understand the needs of the generation, and there may be a takola, there may be a situation where even though the Torah would technically allow it, but because of the matzah, because of the situation of the generation, it's going to lead, meaning if we interpret the law literally, to a takola, to a downfall, to a pitfall. And therefore, what the Sanhedrin now have to do is go beyond the halacha. This is called meta-halachic. Lechadesh dinim, lahosif oligroa. And for what? For Rosh Shah. Again, not to change the halacha itself, but to make enactments and institute certain laws that will protect us from a takola. But that's not enough. Why? Because the people are very, what should I say, are very inhibited about this. You know, they hear that the Sanhedrin came out with, you know, with an Iser. You know, you're not allowed to drink Cholav Akum. You know, so they got nervous. You know, what do you mean? I've been drinking, you know, milk from a guy for the last 100 years. Now you're telling me the Sanhedrin made a takona that you're not allowed to do that. So what's the godless of the Sanhedrin? And that's what he means by Letairis HaSheretz. Lahavi smach min haTorah. To look into the Torah, which again, the Torah says clearly this is mutter, and find some sort of an illusion, a smach, to base your case on that this should be awesome. Now we go on to number four, the Marsha. Very creative. The Marsha says the following. Kavanas hadvarim hi she'ein lahoshiv b'sanhedrin ele misha yochel lilmod zchus al achayav. Somebody really, according to the law, should be condemned as accused, to try to find some sort of limud zchus, to look for some sort of, you know, this ties into what we said before about balei zikna, that Rabbi Yonah says they have to be imbued with compassion. The Torah says, "V'tzilu ha'eder." We have to do everything we can to try to save the accused. Again, this is the Torah Ashkof. I don't know what the Torah would say about terrorism today. So I don't want you to walk out of here thinking that the Torah is a liberal, bleeding heart, liberal, what do they call them today? Democrats or whatever they call them. They have different names for them as, you know, with the passage of time, but all these left wingers. I don't know if the Torah is left wing, but the Torah does say, "V'tzilu ha'eder," that if somebody is being accused and condemned of a crime, we have to look for some sort of limud zchus. And the mashal, and I want to emphasize this word, because this is where the marsha becomes very creative, ha-mashal bazeh, hu l'tayr es hasheretz. the words Litaris Hashetz according to Rasha are a mashal. They're only a metaphor. Shafilu Dovashet Tomei Bevadek Mosheretz Yodeahu, this Chacham, who's on such a high level in Sanhedrin, Lechapes Lo Schus Litaro, he'll still look at the Sheretz and come up with some possible merit that we could be mitar the Sheretz. And as we go through Rav's Kal Vachomer from a Nochash, we'll see that Rav is trying to find some sort of limud schus that maybe we could be mitar the Sheretz. That's how the Marshal learns his Gemara. The whole business about Litaris Sheretz is all a Marshal. And now we have the Binyan Shlomo. The Binyan Shlomo, if I'm not mistaken, was a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. I'm not sure. I don't have my access to my the Beis Alkeit Svarim. That's where you find out who wrote these Svarim. Anyway, he says the following. This is number 5. Kavona Sagumara Bozehi. She'im min adin hayit tzorach letayres asheretz mikol tuma af al pichein tim oso haTorah azay yishlom shemashet tima oso haTorah chidushu. The point of this exercise to try to find a logical kal vachomer that would determine that a sheretz is not mitame is to come to the conclusion of chidushu. Let's try to explain as we go along what this concept chidushu means. Because chidushu is a very technical term that has its own very specific meaning. Klal hu biyadenu, shemi chidush lo yalfinan. We have 13 principles from which we derive halachos. Right, those are called the Yud Gimel Midos Shatorah Nidreshes Pahen. But there's one exception that overrides all 13 principles. That's called what? Chidushu. So for example, the Gemara in Chulin tries to derive a principle called Tam Ki Ikar from Basa B'chol. The Gemara says, no, even though you have a logical deduction from Basa B'chol, but we can't derive anything from Basa B'chol because Basa B'chol Chidushu. Well, the Gemara in Bava Kama wants to derive conclusions from Eid Zomeim, that we believe the second period, and we don't believe the first period. The Gemara says chidushu, or for example, kavua. This halacha that if the suffix is nolad bekvius, then kemechts al mechtsadomi. The Gemara says no, don't derive any conclusions because it's a chidush. So that's a technical term, the mechanics of which that we find in one case this halacha. We can't use that as the paradigm to teach me every other case, which is called a binyan av, because it's a chidush. We need a person to sit on the Sanhedrin who's capable, says the Binyan Shlomo, of defining a chidush. And lefichach ein lilmod, we're not going to derive from this kal vachomer l'shar tumos. In other words, if the Torah, despite the logic of the kal vachomer, is going to tell us that a sheretz is mitameh, then let's not extrapolate and by analogy compare it to other cases because it's a chidush. And that's the point of this kal vachomer. The goal of this kal vachomer is to tell you that sheretz really, according to the laws of the Torah, should be tar. And if it should be tar, if the Torah says it's tameh, don't derive any conclusions in other cases through the principle called binyan av, because it's a chidush. Umeacher shematzina b'kam v'komo shagmar lo medes kal vachomer mituma sheretz behechrech tzorch lo m'shein zechidush mikemen shein lilmod l'tar osu mikal vachomer l'fichot docha gmar la'alon es kal vachomer. He asks the following question. The Gemara very soon on the next Omer on Daf Yud Ches is going to reject the kal vachomer of Rav. Why should we reject the kal vachomer of Rav? Adarav, Rav is trying to teach us that the tuma sheretz is a chidush, and we cannot derive other conclusions from Tumas Sheretz. Says the Binyan Shlomo, because in fact, all over Shas, we derive conclusions from Tumas Sheretz to other Tumas. So we make those comparisons. The answer is because Rav's Kal Vachomer is going to be rejected. Of course, if Rav's Kal Vachomer is going to be rejected, we wonder if Rav himself would have been a candidate for the Sanhedrin. Because Rav tells us, Eimo Shivil Sanhedrin, Elamishi Odeh L'Taras HaSheretz. But what it means is that even if you reject my Kal Vachomer, at least I have a Kal Vachomer. So what is the Kal Vachomer of Rav? Amar Rav, ani odun ve'atareno. I'm going to use a kal vachomer to be mitayer es ha-sheretz. And now we turn to Daf Yud Beis, Amud Beis. And I don't think it's any coincidence that we're learning this a day after we read Parshas Bereishis. Uman Achash. The serpent. The serpent is always, you know, the paradigm of tumah, of evil. Shememis. Shememis means that if he bites you, and if he's a poisonous, venomous snake, he'll kill you. And he can kill not only an animal, he can kill a human being as well. Is marvet tumah biolam, right? A dead animal that was killed by the bite of a serpent, or a dead human being, chas v'shalom, is marvet tumah. You know, anybody who comes in contact with the dead body of an animal that's an avela contracts tumah, and how much more so the dead body of a human being, which is called the aviavos hatumah. But what's the status of a nachash? You know, get yourself your own pet nachash. I wouldn't recommend that, but we saw already in the past that there's a mitzvah to kill the nachash, even if somebody claims that he trained the nachash. That's the one case where even those who might disagree with Rabbi Yossi would agree. Anyway, if let's say you pet a nachash, I don't know if you've ever pet a nachash. I think if you go to certain places like that in Florida and other places, you know, they give you to pet the nachash.
Sure.
So you pet a nachash, you're still tar. Even though the nachash, through its power of killing, is going to be marbet tumah. Sheretz, she'eino memis, sheretz, which doesn't kill anyone, these are not venomous animals that will kill you, and therefore v'eino marbet tumah, right? And there's no ribuy of tumah in the world because they're not memis. Is ain't no din, isn't it certain that you hate tar? If the nachash, when you come in contact with his tar, and the nachash is a marbet tumah, how much more so a sheretz, who's not a mamis, and therefore he's not marbet tumah bolam? Certainly if you touch a sheretz, you shouldn't be tumah, you should be tar. I'm pretty impressed. I mean, this is a very solid piece of logic, except I have one problem. Maybe you could straighten me out. I don't know, I have one problem here. A nachash is a mamis. Why? Because the nachash actively bit someone, right? Is another word for biting, maybe a more sophisticated synonym for that.
Right.
You have a thesaurus here, look up the word biting. Anyway, what?
He bit someone.
Yeah, but I'm saying, can you give me... biting is like a kindergarten word, a more sophisticated word from when you study for your SATs, you know? What?
Okay,
yeah, look at a thesaurus. I don't have access.
Strike.
If you have a internet, look up the thesaurus. Is great on the internet. See if strikes, maybe strikes. Okay. Anyway, so the snake bit someone. We'll say it that way, and he actively killed someone. I mean, that was the nachash. So therefore, it makes sense that the result of this action would be marbet tumah.
Sure.
But in the case of a sheretz. I mean, the sheretz is not a dangerous animal. Again, we don't like shrotzim. They're quite repulsive, but you can't say that the sheretz is a mamis. So the chiddush of nachash is that even though the nachash is a mamis, nevertheless, it's not mitame. If you touch a nachash, you're not tame. That I understand. But to derive conclusions to other cases of someone who's not a mamis, meaning to the shrotzim, a sheretz is not a mamis by its very nature. So you're going to tell me, well, certainly, if you touch a sheretz, it should be tar. Maybe there's a difference. In nachash, there's a big chiddush that the Torah says that the nachash is not metame. Why? Because the Torah says that nachash is not metame. But I don't know how you derive conclusions about sheretz. Let me read to you the next line in the Gemara and see if we can fit our problem into the Gemara. The Gemara says, Velohi. Don't be fooled by this Kal Vachomer. It's not a reliable Kal Vachomer. So again, you know, he wants to prove that if you touch a dead mouse, you're not Tomei. No, that's not so. Why? Because there's no chumra in the fact that a nachash is a mamis, and it's marbetum viola. Midi davi akotz bialma. What would you say is the status of a coats? A coats means a thorn, right? Or a very sharp piece of wood. Now, if you take that sharp piece of wood and use it like as a dagger, you could actually kill somebody. And you could be marbet tumah biolam. But yet, in the case of coats, despite the fact that it's marbet tumah biolam, if you touch a coats, you don't contract tumah. So therefore, what does Rav have here in his comparison here between Nachash and Shratzen? The Sheretz has the status of a Kotz. The Kotz could be used actively as a Mamis. You know, if you take a Kotz and it's sharp enough and you plunge it very, you know, with a lot of force, you can kill somebody or kill an animal with a Kotz. But nevertheless, I wouldn't call it a Mamis. So therefore, the fact that a Nachash is a Mamis, that's called Marba Tuma Violam. But to say that a Sheretz is in any shape or form comparable to a Nachash, that's not fair. So let me read to you this note over here in the name of the Paras Yosef. I'm not familiar. He says, Efshalomar Shehanidon Bein Shitas Rav Shesover Lochiach Minachash Shitas Agmar Shedacha. So what is going on here? Why does Rav think he has a good case and a valid Kal V'chomer that's reliable and the Gemara rejects it? He says this depends on a machlokes in the Gemara in Bava Kama, in the third parak of Bava Kama. It says like this: Eres, the venom of a nachash. According to one opinion, Bein Shinov hu omed. In other words, the nachash doesn't do anything actively in order to generate this venom. It's Bein Shinov. It's there, you know, it's in its mouth, so to speak. Maybe there's a gland in its mouth. Ulefichach, Dino kikotz mamish. It's the same as a kotz. Sharei kotz eino osa mu'uma mi'atzmo. V'af ha'nochash eino osa mu'uma mi'atzmo. Again, a nochash could bite you, but from the bite you might need a couple of stitches, chas v'shalom, but you're not going to die from it. What you die from is from the eretz, from the venom. And the nochash does nothing to bring that venom up from inside of its lower glands. The other man, Diomer Masechta Bava Kama, says that eretz nochash me'atzmo meki, that he has to spit up that, he has to, so to speak, he has to cough up this venom from his body. And if that be the case, then ein l'damoso l'kotz sharei motzi es ha'eres me'atzmo u'biritzono. Very interesting. You know, I understand the nachash hakadmoni, you know, the original nachash had a ratzon, but now we're saying that every nachash, to some extent, in some vague sort of way, has a ratzon, has a will. And the nachash has to actively produce this venom and then bite someone and kill someone. That's called nachash me'atzmo hu meki. He vomits it up. So this is the machlokas between Rav and the Gemara. Rav maintains the shita that nachash is like what? That nachash is similar to a kotz. What's the similarity between nachash and a kotz? Both are non-deliberate. You know, okay, I guess I'm going to stop here. And I was going to go on, but I can't seem to concentrate. Is it okay if I go on?
Yeah. I'm looking for the word for eject.
Yeah. Okay. To eject?
Inject.
Inject. Okay, to inject its venom. So give me 2 more minutes and we'll try to finish up. So that's the issue. If the nachash is not active at all, it's just that as a result of biting, the venom goes into the body of the one who is infected, then it's similar to a kotz. You know, the kotz is not an active agent here. Somebody has to pick up the kotz and kill someone. And if that be the case, then Rav has a good argument here. And let me just see again. I'll read it one more time. Sorry. Is Ha'im eres nochash bein shinov hu omed, and therefore we're going to say yesh laduno kikotz mamish. Sharei eino ose me'um v'yatzmo eres nochash me'atzmo meki ulefichach ein l'damoso l'kotz. I think he's going the other way around. The Paras Yosef, he's saying the following: that Rav holds that the nochash is the active the active agent. And therefore it's a big chumrah that nachash is not metame, because nachash is really marbe tuma. What does it mean that nachash is marbe tuma? Actively mirtzono me'atzmo is meki. So he actually kills someone as a deliberate act. And yet, the Torah says that he is what? He is not metame. So how much more so the sheretz, who doesn't have any ribui tuma? So now the Gemara says, no. The real equation would be between the nachash and the kotz. And the reason why nachash is not metame is for the same reason that the kotz is not metame. The kotz is not actively and deliberately marbe tuma. So the Gemara rejects the principle of Ra. Okay, does anybody have a pencil that I could borrow just to make a note of where I got up to? Oh, thank you. Okay, so Bli Neder, tomorrow we start the sugya of Shivim Lashon. Remember that Rashi says the problem of Shivim Lashon is that you won't be able to understand the Edim. You'll need a Meturgamon. Correct? Yeah. So tomorrow we're going to get into that whole sugya, and would it be required that all members of the court, every single last one of them, know 70 Lashonos? Maybe we could have three members of the court who they know the Lashonos, and they could hear the testimony, and they could share it with the balance of the judges on the court. So that'll be the sugya for tomorrow. And maybe we'll finish the perek tomorrow. I'm not sure. But if not, then certainly by Tuesday, Rishon, we'll start a new perek. If you know anyone who wants to join us and is afraid to jump in the middle, tell them that Tuesday is a good day to join us.
That's why the nachash is no, because you wouldn't want, if you were afraid to become tummy, you might not kill the nachash. Sakharis Prophet says I'm going to do a special thing for nachash.
Right.
Yeah, that because you're not going to be tummy. Kill it. It's going to come attack you. Kill it.
Right. Don't but
be
you afraid. Have to kill it from a distance.
But don't be afraid.
If you kill it with your hands, then you're going to be tummy as soon as the nachash dies.
Right.
So you might get you first as well.
So, no, but as the Noam, that don't worry about becoming tummy. When you'll kill it. You'll put it. You'll
very
throw
good.
It, throw it away. So that's
very
it.
Good. So definitely an original idea.
Well, I think it's from Rav Palm actually.
Oh yeah. Okay. Very good.
That's what I heard in his
name. Very nice idea. I don't know if that's how we have to learn. But
it could be that Rav Moshe no longer held that 70 languages. 70 languages no longer a requirement. It's just not based in, Sanhedrin. Because wasn't the case you cited about a pacemaker that he'd be puzzled based in? And did Rav Moshe know 70 languages?
I mean, what was the Havani Rav Moshe that he could qualify for the Sanhedrin if he didn't know 70 languages? Okay, so that we'd have to look in the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know, I'm not familiar. Speaking of Shulchan Aruch, if anybody wants to learn Mishnah Berurah, we're around. Okay.